took office last year. Chinese human rights lawyers and activists have experienced one of the worst crackdowns in recent memory. In January, well-known human rights lawyer Su Juyong was convicted of disturbing public order for attempting to hold a protest demanding equal education rights for children of migrant workers. He received 4 years in prison. On March 14th, the world woke to learn that rights activist Cao Shun-li died of tuberculosis while in police custody. Her supporters allege that she was denied medical treatment and was abused in the detention center. What caused the police to detain her? Advocating for civil society and citizens' involvement in China's drafting of its reports for the UN's Universal Periodic Review and of its National Human Rights Action Plan. To put in perspective what exactly is happening on the ground in China and why, is Professor Eva Pils, a professor of law at the Chinese University of Hong Kong. In 2006, Professor Pils wrote the seminal article on human rights lawyers in China, Asking the Tiger for His Skin, Rights Activism in China. This summer, Professor Pils will continue her work with a book on rights activism entitled China's Human Rights Lawyers, Advocacy and Resistance. Thank you for joining us today, Professor Pils. Let's start with a little bit of background. So these human rights lawyers, who are most frequently referred to as rights defense or rights defending lawyers, when did they first start to emerge and why?
Thank you. I think that they used to call themselves rights defense or Wei Quan lawyers, but I think that actually over the past 1 or 2 years, they've started preferring the term Ren Quan Shi, which means human rights lawyers. And that's in a way related to how they emerge. They emerge because in the post-Mao era, especially from the 1990s onward, it became possible to use the law to defend rights. For one thing, of course, because there was law, and it was only under the Deng Xiaoping reform and opening policies that law became an accepted tool of governance by the party state, after it had been completely denounced as a, in essence, as a kind of counter-revolutionary idea in the last decade under Mao Zedong. And then the other thing is that there was a period in the 1990s when the party state authorities were essentially encouraging the use of law to address certain kinds of disputes, certain kinds of conflict in society. And during that time, Wei Quan, rights defense, was actually an officially promoted term. As background, I suppose one should have to say that rule by law, yifa zhiguo, was an idea that the authorities were making use of in the Deng Xiaoping era in order to claim political legitimacy, and that in a way replaced the political legitimacy coming from the idea of a communist revolution that was the pattern what legitimate political legitimacy was based on in the Mao Zedong era. So I think that argument is quite right. This is how Deng Xiaoping wanted to develop China in the post-Mao era. But also, I think that the authorities, perhaps including Deng Xiaoping, didn't fully realize what they were letting themselves in for when they promoted the idea of Wei Quan. So in that sense, perhaps it's because they were quite good Marxist-Leninists and believed sincerely that law was nothing other than a tool of governance to be used by the ruling power. Whereas, of course, from a Wei Quan, a rights defense perspective, it is connected to justice, and it's connected also potentially at least to political resistance through the idea of rights, of human rights. And I think that it's a step towards a more explicit political agenda that the lawyers who used to be referred to as Wei Quan lawyers have now chosen to call themselves human rights lawyers.
And in terms of the political agenda and the agenda of the human rights lawyers in China, in terms of their issues, is there something that unifies them as a single issue, or are they different issues? And in general, are they located in one area, or do you find them throughout the country?
I think in terms of area, yeah, definitely. There's a huge concentration in Beijing, and perhaps also in a couple of other cities, in particular Guangzhou, and of course also Shanghai and so on. But when you look at how they work and where they work, it's very important to see that they really work all across the country. And of course, for instance, the Jianzhanjiang case that you mentioned just before, where you have a couple of human rights lawyers going to this extremely remote location in Heilongjiang with the purpose of freeing, or in any case, providing legal support to a couple of people who are extra legally detained there. That's a perfect example of what human rights lawyers do, regardless of where they are based. Is there something that unifies them? Well, my impression, having done so many hundreds of interviews over the past couple of years with, I suppose, a few dozen human rights lawyers, they're very diverse, they're very different in terms of their personalities, their approach to their work, some of their convictions. But of course, there are things that do unite them, and I think that, for one thing, they see themselves as adopting different methods from what many other lawyers are prepared to do, and for instance, they reject the idea of sort of wining and dining the officials concerned in their client's case to get results. In that, they're not different from a group of lawyers called Kerpai lawyers, lawyers who are sort of very uncompromising. But what sets them apart from the Kerpai lawyers is that they are willing to take on cases that nobody else would want to touch. And I suppose that, one good example for that is the cases of people who practice Falun Gong. And then maybe thirdly, they have recently started identifying more clearly around political ideas. They want democracy.
Okay. So just in terms of the crackdowns that we're seeing, and I think you talked a little bit about this in your previous answer, there has always been crackdowns on dissent in the People's Republic of China, even in the post-Mao era. I mean, you see the 1978 Democracy Wall movement, there's a crackdown. You see the Tiananmen protest in 1989, there's a crackdown. Should we be surprised that the same Chinese Communist Party is looking to crack down on these rights defense lawyers and activists?
No, we should not be surprised. And I don't think that, I don't think that the lawyers are surprised either. And I say that although I just said that initially in the 1990s there was this official promotion of and use of the idea of rights defense, there was, I think, for some a couple of years, especially sort of around 2003 when you had the famous Sun Jiegang incident, this notion that perhaps rights defense could mean a kind of bold group of courageous lawyers, legal professionals, legal academics sympathizing with them, persuading the state to introduce these incremental reforms. One of them, for instance, could have been to introduce some sort of meaningful constitutional adjudication, whichever mechanism that would have used, it would have made a potentially very great contribution towards making constitutional rights guarantees more effective in actual people's lives and in actual legal practice in China. So you have that hope. And of course, along with it, an expectation that the state would tolerate Wei Quan. But actually, very early on, from the moment almost when they started being successful, these Wei Quan lawyers also encountered repression. And I think we now understand better than perhaps a couple of years ago that that was really based in high level perception that Wei Quan was presented a political challenge, and that consequently it had to be controlled. What has been happening since beginning in 2004, and especially over the past couple of years, has been a tightening of control and the use of increasingly frightening ways of trying to stop lawyers from engaging in Wei Quan. And I don't think that anyone I have spoken to has been surprised by what has happened.
So in terms of that, the tightening of control, and you mentioned that the Sun Jiagang case in 2003 is kind of a high point. But then by 2009, we see the government of one big crackdown with Gao Zhisheng basically being abducted and being held incommunicado. Also in 2009, you see the disbarment of activist lawyers like Tang Jitian and Liu Wei. You see Su Jiyong being investigated. Then in 2011, you see with the Arab Spring, we see another crackdown. And now, 2013, 2014, we are perhaps seeing some of the worst treatment of advocates. So you were talking about how some of the responses is coming from high level. I think a lot of people see these different crackdowns as separate incidents, just a knee-jerk reaction by the Chinese Communist Party. But should we see it that way, or should we see it as a larger trend?
Well, I think that it is based on a decision that, as I just said, was essentially made in 2004, that there would have to be control. And I think that that basic attitude and policy has remained the same, also before and after the some change in leadership. So I definitely think that this is part of a larger trend. I think that also the situation at the moment is worsening.
So what is it? I think we can guess what it is that the Chinese government is so afraid of, but what precisely is it? Is it the issues themselves, or is it another power base that could take away power from the party? What is that? Is it that they're so afraid of?
From the perspective of the Chinese authorities, or at least from that part of the Chinese government that is entrusted with the task of stability preservation of Weiwen, it's quite clear, and perhaps it's clearer to them than to lots of people outside of China and inside China. It's quite clear that the human rights movement, of which human rights lawyers are of course an important part, stands for political ideas that challenge the party's political existence, really. And I think that of course you have a perception also amongst the establishment that the current system isn't viable unless it's somehow changed. But I think that what sort of leads to this attitude of having to crack down on human rights lawyers is that essentially the establishment, the authorities, are completely reluctant to let any civil society force take control of the changes that need to be introduced. So yes, there may have to be changes, but certainly we, the party state, want to stay in control of these changes. And another way of putting the same thing, I suppose, is to say that the Qijunlei forces, the system, the establishment, can't accept the idea of accountability to people outside of the system, and in a way it's not institutionally set up to accept that idea. That of course means that the notion, the idea of a political opposition, the idea of a free, open, political discussion of the grievances, popular grievances, the causes of social unrest, the various deeply contentious issues that we do have in Chinese society right now is even less acceptable.
So just to get a little bit more specific, I want to turn now to focus on Su Jiyong, who just received in January 4 years in prison. He's part of this New Citizens Movement, Can you describe what that movement is a little bit, and where did it emerge, and what its platform is?
So the New Citizen Movement, it emerged in 2012, around May 2012, and I think that it, of course, can be seen as, in some ways, a response to the problems that we have just been discussing, the grievances, also the problem of repression of civil society. In some ways, of course, it's also changing, sort of due to changes that that have come about because of new communication technologies, the social media, and so on and so forth, and that have enabled a new form of activism to emerge, and not only in China but also in other parts of the world. You know, think of the various Occupy movements and you know, the Arab Spring, and so on and so forth. So that's, I think, sort of one of the reasons why the New Citizen movement emerged. Now, obviously, it focuses on the idea of the citizen, and when you look at what Xu Zhiyong in particular has said, has provided as an analysis of citizen, the concept of the citizen. You can see that it's a very strong, richly normative political conception of the citizen, the citoyen of sort of 18th century Europe, the notion of a person, the individual who has rights against the state. And I think that looking at the history of the human rights movement that we just discussed, you could perhaps also say that Xu Zhiyong had this idea that having tried for 10 years to introduce beneficial changes in China through case-by-case legal advocacy, legal rights advocacy, sort of comes to the conclusion around 2011, 2012, that now a new method of advocacy has to be tried, that rights advocacy in a way has to move beyond individual, working on individual cases, and become more issue focused and more explicitly political. So how do you do that in the context of a political system that very clearly does not allow a political opposition? And like in other places in the world, the answer that seems to be emerging in China right now, as I see it, is to adopt forms of organization that are significantly different from what we've seen before. And in Cheng Biao, another, of course, very important scholar and rights advocate, has used Claire Shirky's idea of organizing without organization to describe what's going on. The idea is basically that you could achieve a high degree of coordination, of initiation of various types of actions, civil society actions, without having a visible traditional organizational structure. And it's also this idea that in a new civil society stroke political movement of this kind, you have to be very open. So you have to be the very opposite of what characterizes, for instance, the rise of the Chinese Communist Party from its sort of underground years to sort of this moment when it manages to control power. And I mean, an example for that would, for instance, be the so-called Guminjuchan, the citizen meals that were organized by the New Citizen Movement. The idea was really that you would somehow get people sort of distribute information about venue and time and so on online. And in some of the cases, some of the Guminjuchan, the citizen meals that I've observed, it really was possible for people who simply had come across this information online to come along and join such a meal. So it was entirely open. towards anyone who wanted to show up. And that's remarkable in the context of the system that, as you just said a while ago, is so scrutinizes everybody so much and has so much surveillance. But the idea really was that this sort of openness represented a new form of political power that could be used to initiate some sort of change. And along with that, of course, goes the idea that the activism of the new citizen movement must be non-violent.
Right.
So, I mean, just in terms of numbers, like, what are we looking at in terms of, I mean, how big would you estimate the movement is, if you can even do that? And, if you know.
Wow, well,
you know.
Yeah. Well, I suppose, I mean, on the numbers, I have to say, I don't know. Of course, we have asked those questions in various settings. There's no very clear answer. Perhaps one could say that in 2013, we had, let's say, in a number of, say, around 30 or so different Chinese cities, you had a total of perhaps a couple of hundred people who were sort of centrally involved in initiating and organizing these meals. And by the way, the idea was basically that you would have a meal being held at the same time in different locations all over China, potentially. And so you had these 30 cities, you had a couple of hundred people. Perhaps that means a few thousand people who would be willing, you know, to show up for one or two or more of those, who would be in some ways supporting the idea of the new citizen movement. Perhaps it would be good if we had access to, I have not, the list of people signing the so-called 公民承诺, the sort of citizen's pledge that was issued in 2010, and was a kind of appeal to citizens from all walks of life to essentially pledge to being a good citizen using this political idea that Xu Zhiyong stands for and others stand for. Something else perhaps to consider would be the level of support that Gongmeng, the organization co-founded by Xu Zhiyong, got for its activism on equal educational rights for migrant worker children. And as I recall, that at the time it was said that in Beijing, they would be able to essentially reach tens of thousands of migrant worker parents. And certainly they were thinking big, I suppose. They were thinking that they could reach out to potentially anyone. And also, if you look at the composition of those citizen meals, it wasn't, of course, just lawyers. It was also not just people, not just scholars, lawyers, people with a legal education background or that sort of background, but it was also people who were petitioners and people who just took an interest in what was going on there.
You raised the issue of migrant education for migrant children as one of the issues which would require some kind of change to the hukou system. And some of the other things that I think the New Citizens Movement advocates, like more transparency of Chinese officials and their assets. These are, in fact, that in the past year, reforms that the Chinese government has stated that they're looking to examine or to adopt. So it seems like the Chinese government is sort of listening to the New Citizens Movement, or at least their complaints. But then how do you mesh that with the fact that they're arresting the advocates of that movement for disturbing public order? I mean, what gives here?
I'm not so sure about that analysis. I think that when you look at what the new citizen movement has advocated, of course you have some similarity with certain measures, reform policies announced by the Chinese government. But I don't think that that is by points out evidence that the government is following suggestions from the New Citizen Movement. I mean, for one thing, of course, these reform ideas were around before, quite long before the New Citizen Movement even emerged. But, I mean, perhaps more important is that you could also see this as sort of the other way around. And this is how it was analysed by people involved in the various movements currently that you currently have in China. People were saying, well, in some ways, the New Citizen Movement has chosen to talk about causes that the government had already said it had adopted. And that might be a way of being... coming across as a little bit less provocative than if you do what very clearly and visibly was done, especially in the south of China, by various movements sort of around Guo Feixiong, another very important rights advocate, of course, who is based in Guangzhou.
Yes.
And there, what you had there was really the use of much more aspiring and much more abstract political slogans, constitutional government, democracy, human rights, in those words. And so you had this very interesting discussion within these smaller sub-movements, if you like, these various groups within the human rights movement. And some people who were critical of the New Citizen Movement were saying was that essentially it was not a good strategy to choose government slogans. I remember one person saying basically you shouldn't think that the government is that stupid. Those were his words. You shouldn't think the government is that stupid that just because you shout the government slogans, they won't come and they won't come after you. They're not going to let you off just because you shout the identical, you use identical slogans and campaign causes. And the reason for that being, of course, that as long as you make political demands of any kind, they will assume that you want a share of the political power, and that's what the government won't accept. So from that perspective, what they were seeing was an attempt to be a little bit less provocative by joining, by using campaign causes that were a bit similar to the government, but that strategy essentially not really working. And I think that, there's a whole lot more to say about the differences, of course, between what the New Citizen Movement, other movements were calling for, and what the government has so far delivered, for instance, when it comes to anti-corruption and so on.
Right, right. So you wouldn't say that the government is co-opting the movement?
No, I don't think so.
And just going back to the government, I want to finish with one last question is, you know, in the government and its relation to the rights activists, recently, late 2013, early 2014, you're seeing a lot of rhetoric coming from the Chinese Communist Party calling for things like judicial independence, greater respect for lawyers, and I think there's some people in the West who has seen this as a positive development, that it's showing that the government wants incremental legal reform and that there's space then. But my question to you, given this crackdown that's happened, should we see this rhetoric as anything positive? How should we view it? And how should you view the rhetoric that's happening simultaneously with this very severe crackdown on rights lawyers?
Yeah, well, maybe answering this question does require looking at least briefly at some of the reform measures or the changes since under the new leadership. And I mean, I think the anti-corruption campaign is probably a good example. I think it would be, personally, I think it would be quite a mistake to see that as a new leadership coming in and trying to essentially provide sort of establish a basis for further reaching reforms that ultimately sort of end in this end goal of the democratization, liberalization narrative, which is a stable rule of law system with increasing political openness and so on and so forth. Because if you look at what actually happens in the anti-corruption campaign on the ground, I think that I believe it would be really hard to deny that people who do end up being investigated for corruption due to corruption allegations are really those who have somehow lost protection from within the system. It is, after all, it remains a party decision who will be investigated for corruption. And so another way, and perhaps a more accurate way of seeing what is going on under this so-called anti-corruption campaign is actually a party purge, a party internal purge that serves the ultimate goal of strengthening and centralizing control under the central leadership and centralizing the control by Xi Jinping. So that is really very, very far from sort of construction of the rule of law, which of course would also require some moves against corruption, but those would take the form of the use of the judicial process, an open process, and a rule of law based process, and all of that I don't think we are seeing clearly at all. I mean, just think of the fact that high-ranking officials who are targeted are not processed just through the judicial system, but rather just as they used to be before, they are put under some sort of party internal detention and so on and so forth. So I think that that tells us a lot about the sort of liberalization narrative that you just brought up. I think it is a very powerful narrative, and it has been extremely attractive also for essentially anyone who has tried to engage China from the outside, all the many foundations, foreign governments, institutions who have tried to strengthen rule of law development in China over the past decades. And I think that, of course, from the perspective of all of those institutions and individuals working with them, they're very powerful reasons, important reasons for wanting to see this kind of incremental reform process that you mentioned, and to make constructive contributions to this process without, at the same time, without alienating the authorities. But for the reasons I just gave, I don't think that we see, we have evidence from on the ground that this is what is happening. And of course, that means also that this powerful, attractive, but then also somehow a little bit anesthetizing narrative of gradual liberalization it just doesn't work. In China, amongst academic circles and so on, I think you can see that reflected in a shift of vocabulary away from constant uses of the word reform, judicial reform, Sifagaiga, and so on and so forth. I think that people are becoming more critical of that idea because they reached the conclusion that it does not seem to be working. And they are talking more broadly about change, and I think that, what I would take away from that shift is that, of course, that agency in change, in legal political change, does not necessarily lie with the government. I think that increasingly the momentum has shifted to civil society, including the human rights movement.
Just as one last question, is what do you see short term for the future of human rights advocates in China? Not long term, just short term. I mean, do we see it getting worse, or do you not even want to try to get?
Well, I think that yes, we do see it. For the moment, we see it getting worse, and I would be very pleasantly surprised if there were sudden sort of loosening of sort of lightening of the pressure and so on and so forth. The events of the past couple of weeks and months have sent very strong signals that it is quite likely that more lawyers will be detained. We are now unfortunately finding that human rights defenders, when detained, can be expressed in very significant levels of violence. And of course you mentioned the terrible news of the death of Cao Shunli. I think that what is interesting is that despite all this repression, despite the worsening long-term crackdown, you also have a rise in numbers of human rights lawyers. You have more and more lawyers showing solidarity with human rights lawyers and actually showing, expressing a willingness to be called human rights lawyers, identifying with this human rights cause. And what I also found remarkable is that human rights lawyers are amongst the most optimistic people I speak to when I go to China.
Okay, well, I guess, yeah, the increase in numbers, I mean, that gives us some hope in the midst of all this despair. But I want to thank you, Professor Pills, for your time and for letting us know and trying to figure out what's happening on the ground in China. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
This morning I woke, restless and heady, with blood pulsing fierce in the vein. There's light on a line this morning and maybe forever. I move with regard for the signs. You know I've searched my heart to prove there's better ways to push and pull. Hey, whatever gets you through these days.